Before we get there, I just want to make sure that I'm hearing this right. So they go, I mean, this is a bird that is, you know, designed for extinction, I think, not for survival. Somehow it lays eggs. That itself seems like a miracle to me. And this team of researchers, they go in and steal those eggs, essentially, and replace it with 3D printed high-tech eggs that create what? Give out heat and make some noise?
They make sounds like an egg would.
And then they take these stolen eggs and what do they do with them?
They bring them back to their lab and they put them in incubators. And basically they just monitor them every hour of the day to make sure they're doing everything they can to ensure the egg hatches.
My guest today is Rachel Bale. She's executive editor of the Animal Desk at National Geographic, where she oversees digital and magazine coverage of all things animals. She also manages and occasionally reports for Wildlife Watch, Nat Geo's investigative reporting project that focuses on wildlife crime and exploitation. Rachel, welcome to Life Meet Tech.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about animal conservation, technology is not something that pops into my immediate memory right off the bat. What do you think is the relationship between technology and our relationship with wildlife in general?
I think like any part of our lives now, technology is being used to make things easier and better and faster. And that's what we're seeing in the wildlife space too. There's been a lot of advances in technology that's used to monitor wildlife populations, for example, to count them and keep an eye on their conservation status, and also in particular to fight wildlife trafficking, poaching especially.
And can you give us an example of how technology is used as a surveillance tool to minimize poaching or to fight against poaching?
Yeah, so this is one of the most common areas we see technology, you know, being really creative in the wildlife space. So for example, thermal imaging is now being used in some places. Some astrophysicists got together with some wildlife conservationists and developed this setup with thermal imaging cameras on a drone. And the drones then can patrol a much, much wider area than rangers can. And since poachers normally hit at night, it can be really hard to tell where are the animals. Is that a person? What's going on? I can't really see. But with thermal imaging, it's really obvious when you see a human walking across toward a couple of animals.
So, Rachel, there is this very interesting story about riverine rabbits in South Africa and the use of drones and infrared cameras to track them. Can you tell us more about this?
So there's this really, really rare rabbit in South Africa called the riverine rabbit. And I think only about 1,000 have ever been seen before by anyone, anywhere. But by putting a thermal imaging camera on a drone going way up high in the sky, you can suddenly observe so much more habitat and very easily point out where there are animals and determine whether or not they're one of those rabbits. And in this way, the camera was able to pick up 5 riverine rabbits that hadn't been seen before. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when only 1,000 have ever been seen, 5 is a whole lot.
And just the heat given off by even a small rabbit is enough for these cameras to catch them in a great amount of detail. Is that correct?
It makes it really easy to find them. I wouldn't say you can see a whole lot of detail on the rabbits themselves, but you can absolutely spot them because you'll be looking at, you know, this sort of purple, pink screen, and then all of a sudden there's a bright yellow rabbit-shaped thing in the middle.
But drone technology in general has had a profound influence on how we understand wildlife, correct? Can you give us another example of how drones are used to estimate populations?
Because you can go up high in the sky and take such a zoomed out view, it makes it much easier to get an entire herd of elephants or giraffes or zebra in one screen, making them much easier to count. Whereas if you were doing that on the ground, for example, researchers would maybe do a transect. They would have to walk miles counting every animal they see, or they would walk back and forth in, you know, zigzag pattern counting animals. Instead, you have one big picture from above. It's really easy. Just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Among all the drone stories, the one that I really took a fancy for was the story about the Muppet-faced flightless parrot. And this is an incredible story. Anybody who loves technology and anybody who loves the underdog must love this parrot. Tell us a little bit about this parrot. Can it fly or what does it do?
I was hoping you'd ask me about the kakapo because this is one of my favorite technology stories. So it's this New Zealand parrot. It's flightless and it's nocturnal. So it's just a bizarre bird to begin with. And we always say its face is sort of a combination of an owl and a Muppet. If you use Slack at work, for example, you might be familiar with the party parrot GIF. That's how I recognized it anyways. But basically, this parrot, it's critically endangered. There are fewer than 150 left. They're found only in New Zealand. And they're not great at survival.
Right. How did this parrot survive all these years? I mean,
so they were fine on their islands until invasive species came in. When the rats came in, when the cats started eating their eggs, started eating them, then they were in trouble. But even without those extra threats, these birds only breed every 2 to 4 years. Half or maybe less of the eggs that they lay are fertile. And then of those fertile eggs, only a fraction of the chicks that hatch survive. So they're super, super tough to help reproduce, but there's only 150 left. So people are trying really hard. The technology story with the kakapo begins with tiny backpacks with transmitters. You can put a GPS tracker, which are now so small and light and unobtrusive, you can attach it to a bird with the little straps that are almost like a backpack around the bird's wings. And that allows researchers, they have transmitters, so that allows researchers to track like when two birds come together to mate, or where a bird is building its nest, or how often a female leaves her nest to go get food. And so understanding those behaviors is really important to helping them survive. But it gets better. The next cool technology they use for these birds are 3D printed smart eggs. So because there are so few fertile eggs, and because so few of those chicks that do hatch actually grow up, when a female lays eggs, scientists come in and they take the eggs from her nest and they bring it into their lab, an incubator where they can monitor it really closely and do everything they can to make sure it survives. But you can't just take an egg away from a bird. She's going to think her bird is gone. Eventually, the chick has to go back to the nest. So to make the female believe that she's still sitting on her egg, there are 3D printed eggs that make sound, like, and kind of move kind of like if they had a chick in them. So the female sits on that.
That is just amazing.
And then eventually, most of the time, she gets her chick back to raise. Do you want to know about the cloacal courier?
Yes, I'm sorry. This is so funny, but also it is very endearing. Do carry on. What is the next step here that how technology is used?
All right. The next step is actually my favorite. It's better than a bird backpack and better than a 3D printed smart egg. It is artificial insemination delivered by drone. The scientists have nicknamed this drone the cloacal courier. This may be too much information, but for people who don't know, birds only have one opening on their rear end, and it's called a cloaca. That's for their digestive tract, reproductive, sure, urinary tract. So that's cloacal courier. Basically, because there are only about 150 of these birds left, inbreeding is a big threat. And that's probably part of the reason why so many eggs don't survive is because there just isn't enough genetic diversity left in this population. So they have done DNA sequences of every single bird's genetics and identified the most genetically important males, the ones who have the biggest variety of genes to offer, in order to try to keep this gene pool diverse. So they take semen from these genetically important males, and the way they get them from one side of the island to the other is they attach it to this drone, and the drone flies the semen over to where the females are, and then the scientists can pick it up and do their artificial insemination.
Oh my goodness, that is amazing. It's just funny, but at the same time, there is something at its very core. It shows the power of technology to redeem or to effect positive change, and particularly when we think about vulnerable populations in the human realm, vulnerable populations, as well as universal access. These efforts are intended to empower people with, you know, less power in society. And I see the same thing applied here in the animal kingdom, a bird that is just not fit for survival, but the introduction of technology to somehow uplift this species. That's really, really quite compelling.
It's been amazingly successful too. In the 1990s, there were, I think, about 50 of the birds left, and now we're up to about 150. So they're still very much in trouble, but that's a huge increase.
It's a terrific story, and it's heartwarming. And it appears that this species has a following, right? The bird has a following online, yeah?
Oh, yes. So obviously, this kind of work is expensive, and so there's a lot of fundraising that goes into it. And there's one kakapo named Sirocco who was raised in captivity, and he is sort of the spokesbird for the project. For this conservation project. And he has his own Facebook page with a couple hundred thousand followers. And one of my favorite videos to watch on YouTube, he attempted to mate with Stephen Fry's head. A nature documentary he was filming.
Well, I have to say, not for that reason, but in general, the kakapo has become certainly a very important part of my life. I'm going to follow and become a fan of the kakapo.
Oh, yes.
I want to move on to surveillance. We're talking about technology and an important tool in fighting against poaching and ill treatment of animals. Help us understand how technology is used in the fight against poaching.
Yeah, so for many species, poaching is their biggest threat. For example, elephants, their biggest threat to survival is poaching in the ivory trade. Some 30,000 African elephants are killed for their ivory each year.
30,000?
30,000, yeah, out of a population about 400,000. So that's quite significant. Fighting poaching is a whole big, complicated endeavor, but one of the things you can do is start at the very beginning by making sure that you're detecting people who are coming into parks and wildlife areas to try to kill the elephants. So that goes back to surveillance. We've got the thermal imaging cameras that can pick up heat signatures of humans. There's software that uses machine learning to be able to detect, is this the shape of an elephant? Is this the, you know, unique thermal pattern of a human? So even though you can't have individual humans everywhere, you can still have surveillance over a much larger area. They're doing similar things with acoustics monitoring. This is super interesting to me. So in the Republic of Congo, for example, there's something called the Elephant Listening Project, which is with Cornell University and Wildlife Conservation Society. They've gone into this forest and put up 50 microphones all around the forest, an area about 500 square miles, about the size of LA. And these microphones are constantly listening to sound in the forest. So that means whenever there's a gunshot, somebody poaching or hunting illegally, the people who are monitoring the microphones can hear it. And what it does is basically it allows law enforcement to change their approach so they can focus their energies exactly where the activity is happening. So it lets you hear sort of the man-made sounds and pick them out of the natural background. I think we have a clip of that we can play, right?
Wow, that is, yeah, that makes you stop and think.
Obviously, at this point, the shots have been fired. So if they were aiming at an animal, the animal is already dead. But it does allow them to deploy quickly and know exactly where they should deploy to. So it increases the chances of catching the poachers. And it also serves a deterrent effect. If people know that they fire their gun and somebody is going to notice and come to that spot, then they're less likely to do that.
So it's not just knowing that it happened within a big forest, but it can somehow zero in on a particular zone or an area in which it occurred. And that itself is very helpful, right?
Exactly. They know where each of those microphones are. And so you can triangulate the sounds to pinpoint most likely where it came from.
When looking at some of the stories in Nat Geo, there was one particularly from Singapore where they found elephant tusks that was hidden among that was supposed to be wood. Can you tell us about this this particular raid and what happened?
Yeah, this is a great example of advancements in DNA technology helping fight the illegal wildlife trade. So in this story, Singapore authorities got a tip. They heard there was probably some illegal ivory that was going to be moving through their port. And so they stopped three containers that had been labeled timber from the Democratic Republic of Congo that were going to Vietnam. And when they opened up those containers, they found almost 9 tons of ivory. That's an estimated 300 elephants or so, as well as 12 tons of pangolin scales. This is like massive, massive seizure of illegal wildlife products. So in addition to, you know, contacting Interpol and their counterparts in DRC, in Vietnam, et cetera, they called up this scientist at the University of Washington called Samuel Wasser. He runs what's called the Center for Environmental Forensic Science, and he has been a pioneer in using DNA technology to track elephant poaching. So what he did with this one, he went and he took samples from all of the tusks that were seized by law enforcement, and then he compared the DNA from the seized elephant tusks to this giant library of known elephant DNA that he's amassed over all of his years of research, and looked for matches. So typically when you're doing a DNA match, you know, think about like a crime scene, you find DNA at the crime scene and you're looking for an exact match. You need that person's DNA to show up in your database in order to make the match. The chances of that happening with elephants are very small. So instead, what Samuel Wasser has developed and proven is that you can do familial matching with elephant DNA. So this is the technique that caught the Golden State Killer, the serial killer in California, for example. Mm-hmm. It's where you take your DNA from the crime scene, or in this case, from the seized elephant tusks, and you compare it to your massive library of elephant DNA. But instead of looking for an exact match, you're looking for partial matches. And if you find a partial match, that means you found a relative of that original DNA sample. So it all sounds complicated, but basically what it allows you to do is take samples from seized ivory and match them to elephants' entire families. And so in doing this, you can basically figure out how different shipments of seized ivory are connected to each other and create these maps of how ivory is moving around the world and what networks are doing it.
Very interesting. So this is some very deep detective work that you can do by linking DNA from different containers that are sent across around different parts of the world. When tusks are shipped, what does it look like? Does it look like a long tusk, or is it cut up in pieces, or is it turned into products? I mean, like combs and this and that, all kinds of other things.
It varies. Usually if it's coming straight from Africa, the tusks are raw. They haven't been carved into anything or turned into any products. You'll either have entire tusks or cut up pieces of tusk because they're easier to hide. Mm-hmm. So often they're, you know, slipped into shipments of, say, timber, where you can, you know, sort of tuck them in and nobody will notice unless you have a sniffer dog or you get a tip that one's coming in.
I've read stories that say that it's important that we deal with the smugglers and others who control this underworld trade. Have you any insights on that?
Yeah, when you're talking about wildlife trafficking, the place you're going to have the most impact is by going after the criminal syndicates. The wildlife trade is organized much like any other kind of organized crime. You have a network with a leader, and it goes all the way down. And the people at the very bottom are the poachers. They're, think of them kind of like the drug mules. They're the ones who are dispensable. They're the ones most likely to get arrested. And they're also the easiest to replace. So going after the poachers themselves is not that effective. You want to go after the higher levels of the criminal syndicates. And one of the things actually that Samuel Wasser's DNA technology helps with is identifying these networks. So if you can connect a shipment of seized ivory in Singapore to a shipment of seized ivory in Thailand, say it turns out two of the tusks are a familial match. So that means the elephant in the Singapore shipment is from the same herd as the elephant in the Thailand shipment. It's highly likely that the same criminal organization is responsible for both of those syndicates. And so you can combine that data with bills of lading and with all kinds of other standard investigative evidence to put together an idea of where these networks are located, how they operate, and that allows law enforcement to really focus their efforts to figure out who is pulling the strings.
Typically, this triangulation, getting the data from the shipment and then cell phone records and a host of other related evidence, who does the detective work and the forensic work in piecing all of that together?
So Samuel Wasser's team at the University of Washington, they've been taking the lead on this because they're the ones who've pioneered the DNA testing, but they work really closely with local law enforcement of whatever particular country. Mm-hmm. And he's also been working on training law enforcement to do this beyond just elephants. They'd like to do it with pangolin scales. Somebody's doing it with giant clams. There's the potential for it to be expanded to all kinds of things.
So Rachel, much like the ivory, tortoiseshells are also highly sought after. How is AI and new technology being used to address this?
So we all know tortoiseshell. I have sunglasses that are made of a faux tortoiseshell frame. It's a material that's been produced in resin for a long time, and we see it all over. But it's easy to forget, this all started with real tortoiseshell. It's made from not tortoises, actually, but a sea turtle, the hawksbill sea turtle. And between the 1880s and about 1990, more than 9 million hawksbills were killed for their shells to turn into tortoiseshell products. So it's a critically endangered species. And even though we can reproduce the patterns so well in resin these days, there are still people who seek out the real thing. So this NGO called Sea Turtles worked with a scientist at Smithsonian's Data Science Lab to develop an app that you take a picture of something with a tortoiseshell pattern, and the app scans the picture and can tell you with 94-95% certainty whether that is real tortoiseshell from an actual hawksbill sea turtle or whether it's faux, made from resin or plastic.
And that's because of pattern recognition. And this technology is not that different from the same technology that's used for facial recognition, for example. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the way they trained the computer, they took 4,000 images of real tortoiseshell products and of fake ones, and they fed it all into the computer. So the computer could look at it pixel by pixel, analyze the shapes and the color patterns, and learn the differences between the real and the fake. And so now when it looks at a sample that, say a tourist who's out shopping, you want to say, oh, is this like a real tortoiseshell comb? Do I actually want to buy this? You take the picture and the computer's been trained to tell the difference.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for joining me on Life Meet Tech. It's really been such an interesting conversation. So many great stories and an enormous amount of terrific work that's going on. But I have to say, the cockapoo really steals the deal for me.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Rachel. That was so much fun. Life Meet Tech is presented by WKAR in association with Michigan State University. Executive producer, Melanie Paul. Audio engineer, Drew Hill. And hosted by me, Prabhu David. Please subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss an episode. And I'll see you next time on Life Meet Tech.